Chapter 1. The Prelude, On Fear and Aristocracy. 1. The story of William Porphyry Benham is the story of a man who was led into adventure by an idea. It was an idea that took possession of his imagination quite early in life. It grew with him and changed with him. It interwove at last completely with his being. His story is its story. It was traceably germinating in the schoolboy. It was manifestly present in his mind at the very last moment of his adventurous life. He belonged to that fortunate minority who are independent of daily necessities, so that he was free to go about the world under its direction. It led him far. It led him into situations that bordered upon the fantastic. It made him ridiculous. It came near to making him sublime. And this idea of his was of such a nature that in several aspects he could document it. Its logic forced him to introspection and to the making of a record. An idea that can play so large a part in a life must necessarily have something of the complication and protean quality of life itself. It is not to be stated justly in any formula. It is not to be rendered by an epigram. As well one might show a man's skeleton for his portrait. Yet, essentially, Benham's idea was simple. He had an incurable, an almost innate persuasion, that he had to live life nobly and thoroughly. His commoner expression for that thorough living is the aristocratic life. But by aristocratic he meant something very different from the quality of a Russian prince, let us say, or an English peer. He meant an intensity, a clearness nobility for him was to get something out of his individual existence, a flame, a jewel, a splendor. It is a thing easier to understand than to say. One might hesitate to call this idea innate, and yet it comes soon into a life, when it comes at all. In Benham's case we might trace it back to the day nursery at Seagate, we might detect it stirring already at the petticoat stage, in various private struttings and valiant dreamings with a helmet of pasteboard and a white metal sword. We have most of us been at least as far as that with Benham. And we have died like Horatius, slaying our thousands for our country, or we have perished at the stake, or faced the leveled muskets of the firing party. Oh, do not bandage my eyes, because we would not betray the secret path that meant destruction to our city. But with Benham the vein was stronger, and it increased instead of fading out as he grew to manhood. It was less obscured by those earthy acquiescences, those discretions, that saving sense of proportion, which have made most of us so satisfactorily what we are. Porphyry, his mother had discovered, before he was 17, is an excellent boy, a brilliant boy, but, I begin to see, just a little unbalanced. The interest of him, the absurdity of him, the story of him, is that most of us are balanced. In spite of occasional reveries we do come to terms with the limitations of life, with those desires and dreams and discretions that, to say the least of it, qualify our nobility. We take refuge in our sense of humor, and congratulate ourselves on a certain amiable freedom from priggishness or presumption. But for Benham, that easy declension to a humorous acceptance of life as it is did not occur. He found his limitations soon enough. He was perpetually rediscovering them, but out of these interments of the spirit he rose again remarkably. When we others have decided that, to be plain about it, we are not going to lead the noble life at all, that the thing is too ambitious and expensive even to attempt, we have done so because there were other conceptions of existence that were good enough for us. We decided that instead of that glorious impossible being of ourselves, we would figure in our own eyes as jolly fellows, or sly dogs, or sane, sound, capable men or brilliant successes, and so forth, practicable things. For Benham, exceptionally, there were not these practicable things. He blundered, he fell short of himself, he had, as you will be told, some astonishing rebuffs, but they never turned him aside for long. He went by nature for this preposterous idea of nobility as a linnet attached in a cage will try to fly. And when he discovered, and in this, He was assisted not a little by his friend at his elbow when he discovered that nobility was not the simple thing he had at first supposed it to be. He set himself in a mood only slightly disconcerted to the discovery of nobility. When it dawned upon him, as it did, that one cannot be noble, so to speak, in vacuo, he set himself to discover a noble society. He began with simple beliefs and fine attitudes, and ended in a conscious research. If he could not get through by a stride, then it followed that he must get through by a climb. He spent the greater part of his life studying and experimenting in the noble possibilities of man. He never lost his absurd faith in that conceivable splendor. At first it was always just round the corner, or just through the wood. To the last it seemed still, but a little way beyond the distant mountains. For this reason this story has been called The Research Magnificent. It was a real research. It was documented. In the rooms in West Thevin Street, that at last, were as much as one could call his home, he had accumulated material for one hesitates to call it a book, let us say it was an analysis of, a guide to the noble life. Thereafter his tragic death came his old friend White, the journalist and novelist, under a promise, and found these papers. He found them to the extent of a crammed bureau, half a score of patent files quite distended, and a writing table drawer full, and he was greatly exercised to find them. They were, White declares, they are still after much experienced handling, an indigestible aggregation. On this point White is very assured. When Benham thought he was gathering together a book he was dreaming, White says, there is no book in it, perhaps two, one might hazard. Benham was dreaming when he thought the noble life a human possibility. Perhaps man, like the ape and the hyena, and the tapeworm and many other of God's necessary, but less attractive creatures, is not for such exalted ends. That doubt never seems to have got a lodgment in Benham's skull, though at times one might suppose it the basis of White's thought. You will find in all Benham's story, if only it can be properly told, now subdued, now loud and amazed and distressed, but always traceable, this startled, protesting question, but why the devil aren't we? As though necessarily we ought to be. He never faltered in his persuasion that behind the dingy face of this world, the earthy stubbornness, the baseness and dullness of himself and all of us, lurk the living jewels of heaven, the light of glory, things unspeakable. At first it seemed to him that one had only, just to hammer and will, and at the end, after a life of willing and hammering, he was still convinced there was something, something in the nature of an open sesame, perhaps a little more intricate than one had supposed at first, a little more difficult to secure, but still in that nature, which would suddenly roll open for mankind the magic cave of the universe, that precious cave at the heart of all things, in which one must believe. And then life would be the wonder it so perplexingly just isn't. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.